Happy May to all the AZMcast listeners. May is a wonderful time of year because it's almost June. We're very excited to have an awesome segment this month on the new THAPCA trial. That's therapeutic hypothermia after pediatric cardiac arrest. Makes a nice acronym too. Just say it. It's fun. THAPCA. THAPCA. It's very, very cool. So we're going to be talking with one of the authors on that trial, who is one of our pediatric intensivists. And whether you know it or not, you may have actually enrolled one of those patients. We're going to be talking about post-cardiac arrest care in pediatrics, which can be easily extrapolated to adults, because after all, adults are just big kids. We'll hear a little feedback from our community medicine providers who are going to tell us how it is. We'll also listen to another beautiful pearl from Dr. Peter Rosen, all tied up nicely with a Brian Drummond peer review. I love May, mostly because I'm not in Tucson and I'm in San Diego right now. However, I will be quickly joining you in the heat, and I can't wait. Can't wait for the steering wheel to melt the skin off of my hands. Can't wait for the air conditioning to blow hot air. New interns, you have no idea what you're in for. But we eagerly welcome you, and now on to AZMcast. So we've been doing this show for almost 2 years now, and we've gone through several iterations of things, segments, speakers, different ideas that we've thrown around. Attached to the email that you may have received is a link to a survey, and I encourage you to please take the survey to let us know what things you like, what things you don't like, what things you would like us to do more of, and what things you would like us to do less of. Although it may not sound like it, we put a lot of time and effort into this, and we really would like to make it more beneficial to you. Some of the segments that I think are really good, you may think are just frankly awful, in which case I want to make sure that all the effort we put into doing this show every month are paid off well in you guys learning something useful. So please, if you get a chance, it's very quick, do yet another survey that's been emailed to you.
You done messed up, Aaron!
Earlier this month, there was a new trial in the New England Journal of Medicine that evaluated therapeutic hypothermia versus normothermia after pediatric cardiac arrest. Now, several people in our own institution at Diamond Children's, or now Banner Children's Diamond Children's Medical Center, were involved in helping to enroll patients and write this paper. We spoke with one of the contributors, Dr. Katri Tippo, who works up in our pediatric intensive care unit. Dr. Tippo gave us some insight into the trials, into the previous papers that led up to this point, and kind of gave us a synopsis of what she thinks this paper means for post-cardiac arrest care. But we didn't let it stop there. We also wanted to ask her, in general, some tips on what to do if you are so fortunate enough to get ROSC on a kid who is in cardiac arrest. She has some great pearls, and those of you that are residents will hopefully get to work with her in the PICU at some point. As a reminder, there will be little bell dings to notify you when we discuss a paper that will be on your screen. I highly encourage you to actually read the paper, or at least the abstract, so that you have some idea of what the paper said before you just take it as gospel. One of the reasons they had to redo this trial is because someone looked at the previous studies and said, they didn't account for this. So don't take every little thing that you see on the news as 100%, and certainly don't take my word for it.
Stage 2, warm liquid goo phase beginning.
So I'm here with Dr. Katri Tippo, and Dr. Tippo is one of the myriad of authors on the new THAPCA trial that just came out, which is looking at therapeutic hypothermia in pediatric cardiac arrest, hence THAPCA. So talking with Dr. Tippo, we were going to discuss a little bit about how we came to this point of looking into hypothermia for cardiac arrest and kind of what the new article shows. So we've had people survive cold water drownings. They come back, they seem to do fine. There's some evidence that patients do really well, especially in VF and VT arrest, that if you cool them, they have a better outcome. What kind of brought us to the point of where we said, well, we need to study this again because, you know, maybe there's something we're not looking into?
So basically, there had been multiple studies in adults, patients demonstrating, so notably the HACA trial demonstrating that therapeutic hypothermia in the immediate post-arrest period conferred a survival benefits with better neurologic outcome. And there had been multiple small studies in other pediatric populations which sort of failed to show benefits. Therapeutic hypothermia has been applied in traumatic brain injury, in cardiac arrest, in hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, with sort of positive and negative results. So in the pediatric ICU community, the thought was, notably upon review of the adult studies, that in fact a large proportion of the patients in the control group were febrile. And so you can look at the HACA trial in two ways. You can look at it as a positive result for therapeutic hypothermia, or you can view it as it proved that fever is bad for you. And so the investigators, so Frank Moeller, Mike Dean, who were the PIs on the THAPCA study, decided that in fact what we should truly test is test hypothermia against normal thermia. And so they designed the study to have two groups randomized in a one-to-one design. One group with therapeutic hypothermia applied within 6 hours of arrest, and the other group with therapeutic temperature modulation to maintain normal therapy over the first 5 days of PICU stay. And both therapies were applied in the same manner, with cooling blankets aggressively applied, to really try to answer this question. And at the same time, there was a study that was started in adult ICU patients in Scandinavia, testing the same theory, that really maybe the adult studies really just proved that fever was bad, not that therapeutic hypothermia was good for you. And so that was sort of the what led to the study.
So in looking at this study, what we kind of see is that there's a beautiful chart graph on there, which you guys aren't going to be able to see because you're listening to this, but there's a beautiful graph on there that shows that they actually did exactly what they wanted to do. They had the patients restored from hypothermia to come right back to normothermia, and they had the patients stay in normothermia. They had a good selection of patients. They had, this is a multi-center trial. It's got all the earmarks of what you'd like to have for a big study like this. And what did we find?
So essentially, they found that there was no benefit for their primary outcome, which was survival at 12 months with good neurologic outcome. And they defined good neurologic outcome as a score greater than 70 on the VABS2 scale. They did quite a battery of neurophysiologic testing following patients out to 12 months. So they did a really rigorous outcome follow-up. And, you know, there are lots of different ways to assess neurologic function post-arrest. And this is the manner that they chose to do it, which hadn't, these outcome measures hadn't been used before in a pediatric ICU trial, but it has good face validity. It's reasonable. It's a well-developed marker of neurocognitive function in children. And so, you know, not surprisingly, in terms of when they compared, after the results were published of the adult study in Scandinavia, we didn't find a benefit to therapeutic hypothermia. They didn't find harm from it either, but given the technical challenges for maintaining hypothermia, the dangers of rewarming potentially patients where they will vasodilate and have electrolyte problems, it doesn't seem like therapeutic hypothermia is a therapy we should be applying to our patients who come in post-arrest.
So I thought these outcome measures were actually pretty good. It's not, did they survive to admission? It's not, did they survive to discharge? It's not, did they survive to 1 month? It's, what was their actual functional outcome after a year? I mean, that's really what matters when you come down to it about post-arrest. So, you know, does therapeutic hypothermia help you survive to organ donation? Well, we didn't, you know, didn't study that, but that's not exactly what we're trying to accomplish. So, you know, if I've got 500 Arctic Suns down in the ED that are going to need something, I'm probably just going to wear them when I go hiking instead. Maybe that'll be a little bit more useful for those. So it sounds like...
I do want to say something, though. You shouldn't let Aaron walk around with the Arctic Suns when he goes hiking, because the model in this study was that you applied cooling blankets, but you set them to 37. So you vary, that's why their graph looks so fantastic. That's why their temperature modulation graph is perfectly centered at 37 degrees. They have very little fever. Like you can see the error bars on the graph, which you can't see, I guess, go just below 38. And that was the, within the highest limit of the error bar, but you set the cooling blanket to 36.5, and then you left it there. And so that's how they achieved their temperature control. They didn't end up having to use a lot of antipyretics. It was that the temperature blanket set to 36.5. And so it regulates the patient's temperature all of the time. And so you still need to do that with a cooling blanket.
Do you anticipate that there's going to be any other research into should we be cooling patients, or do you think this is, you know, a pretty good sign to say we shouldn't?
So I think this really puts the nail in the coffin for the use of therapeutic hypothermia for pediatric cardiac arrest that's out of hospital. I mean, that's what you care about. So it's an excellent study, very well designed, very rigorous adherence to study protocols. I just can't see that there are any holes really to left to answer. Now, the study was, there are two studies within the FAPCA study. So there's the out-of-hospital FAPCA study, and then there's the in-hospital FAPCA study, which are two separately funded studies. Both have the PIs of Frank Muller and Mike Dean. We participated in both. The in-hospital study just closed, stopped enrolling patients this winter. And is slightly larger in size because they needed a larger enrollment of patients for their effect size. But it was stopped before they completed enrollment. So we'll see what the results end up being. But if it was stopped early, it's either futility efficacy was reached based on the numbers they had. And the reason they did two separate studies is because the etiology for arrest is so different between out-of-hospital and in-hospital, and also the thought process being that people have always thought that therapeutic hypothermia was sort of this physiologically appealing therapy that must have a disease for which it's beneficial, you know, because of the cold water drowning. People just think, well, we just have never applied it early enough. Potentially in the in-hospital arrest population, we could apply the therapy earlier in the disease process. And really, is one of the holes you could have said against the out-of-hospital trial would be, well, did you really apply the therapy early enough? But quite frankly, within 6 hours, you could not have applied therapeutic hypothermia any faster than what we did in this study. I mean, I really don't think that consent delayed application of therapeutic hypothermia. And so in a useful time period for which you could apply therapeutic hypothermia to out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, it doesn't have a benefit. And we'll end up seeing as they publish the next study if it has any benefits in the in-hospital cardiac arrest.
So it seems like the only way that therapeutic hypothermia is helpful in arrest is if it's the hypothermia that caused the arrest.
How do I tell them that because of the unfreezing process I have no inner monologue? I hope I didn't say that out loud just now.
So now I talk with Dr. Tippo a little bit about post-resuscitation care after pediatric cardiac arrest. I can tell you that one of the things that I dread working in the peds ER is the page that says blank month old code arrest. There's never any other information, and just this sickness develops in the pit of my stomach. You get everything set, you work the code, and sometimes the scariest moment is when you actually get a pulse back. Then what do I do? So we asked Dr. Tippo exactly those questions. What do we do once we've run the code well enough that we actually get the kid back? Now what do we do in order to get them safely and soundly up to the pediatric ICU and out of the ER as quickly as possible?
So then what can we do about cardiac arrest? So we have a kid that comes in cardiac arrest for a variety of reasons. We need to figure out what it is. But if, you know, we do our resuscitation, we almost always go longer for kids than what we need to because no one likes to let a kid go. And we often get ROSC after giving them enough epi that we just make them, you know, fibrillate from every neuron that they have. So when we get them back, what what should we do from there? Start them on pressors right away? Do we start them on antibiotics empirically? Is there anything specific we should check? I was always taught to get a gas, get a lactate, get some electrolytes, get a blood culture if you can, and try to go for this. Do we go for a central line? I know these are a lot of questions, so maybe we can start with access. If I've got a kid that's back and I've got only an IO in place, what should I be doing in the ER if I don't place a whole lot of pediatric central lines?
Really, you want resuscitative lines, right? So your classic PALs, two large bore peripheral IVs. So if the kid's large enough to, you have your IO, place another peripheral IV so that you have stable access, because we all know that IOs don't last forever. And we don't want to be stuck in a situation where upon transfer up to the PICU, as you move them out of the bed, their IO goes bad and you have no IV access. That stinks. And so two peripheral IVs plus an IO, or one peripheral IV plus an IO, is fine. Now, if you're using high-dose vasoactive infusions, okay, those can go through your IO, but if you have to give them peripherally temporarily, that's fine. And what we'll probably be placing in these kids most often is a femline. If they don't have any concern for neck injury, then I might place an IJ, but I'll always do that under ultrasound. And then it would be unusual, unless they were a teenager, for us to put a subplate in it.
Yeah, I think the lines that I've put in have almost always been FEMS as well, on little kids, you know, little babies, two-year-olds, five-year-olds even. And the size for your central line has always been of a little bit of, oh gosh, how big do I put in? Dale's got a card for this. I just say refer to Dale's card. But remember that if you're resuscitating, that you want a short, fat line. So I would go for the shortest line you have, even if it's a little bit smaller in girth than the other one, just so you can try to get fluids in, and someone can always fix it a little bit later, but it's access.
So I would say in general, I guess under 2 years of age, I use a 4 French line. The trick is, so the internal diameter of the 4 French line is exactly the same as the 5 French line. And so if you don't need the 5, just put in the 4. It's easier to put in. The only kind of downside for placement really is that the guide wire is a little bit more flimsy in the 4 French. And then two years of age, probably up till 10, I'm doing a 5 French, and then after that it's a 7 in the groin.
All right, so we've got ROSC. We actually get a pressure that's, you know, marginal. Say it's 60 over 20 or something like that. What pressor are you reaching for to try to maintain this kid's blood pressure?
So if they've just had return of circulation, we've brought them back with epi. I'm starting an epi drip. I'll do kind of up to 0.05 peripherally if that's all I have, and then higher through the IO or the central line. And the reason, if their blood pressure is marginal, then definitely they'll need to be on a pressor. But being on pressors post-arrest also reduces your risk of rearrest. So that's another reason why, unless a child is hypertensive post-arrest, I start a pressor. So the only reason I don't is if they're already hypertensive.
So you start them on the epi, you titrate up your epi, it's not working. I've had, as we're titrating the epi up, I go, they're not doing okay, give them a half dose of epi, and we get their pressure back up. Titrate up the epi. I usually say double it. No, double it again. No. So once you've maxed out on your epi, what do you reach for next?
Probably norepi second line versus vasopressin.
Okay. So now you've got your epi going. Do you start antibiotics right away? Are most of these kids going to be septic of some kind? Or do we need to get those in before we get them transferred or sent up to the PICU?
So this is going to be a little bit of a straw man in terms of, you can knock them down really nicely. I would say most of these children end up on antibiotics, and it's for a variety of reasons. Usually most cardiac arrest children are previously healthy, something acute happened, and they have an arrest. But you can never be certain, were they septic and that's why they arrested? Is it a respiratory arrest due to pneumonia? Is it, you know, until you have the whole story back, you don't know. So most of these kids are going to be put on antibiotics, either because you're not sure what factors actually cause the arrest. Could it be an infectious bacterial process? Or sometimes we're worried that maybe the lines and the interventions in the emergency room or pre-hospital.
Take that back.
We're not necessarily done. I mean, unavoidably so, under the most sterile of circumstances. Because yes, if you have a kid arresting in front of you, sterile technique is not necessarily number one on your mind.
Is it bad if you go through the diaper to get the central line? Because I've gotten close a couple times.
Yes, so exactly. So there are multiple reasons why the antibiotics. I would say probably 95% of these kids are on antibiotics, even if it's only for the first 24 hours, 48 hours, while we wait for tracheal aspirate results, blood culture results to come back.
And what about labs? What are some of the things that you want to get first to try to help you know where you're at?
So first and foremost, I think that we get a blood gas with lactate that helps overall in terms of prognosis, helping us decide, you know, what's the likelihood that this kid that's now comatose post-arrest when we have return of circulation, how severe was their sort of downtime, for lack of a better term. And then we're checking pancreatic enzymes, liver enzymes, kidney function serially over time to assess end organ damage. We don't check, quite frankly, troponins, cardiac enzymes, because post-arrest there's going to be cardiac muscle leak. And so it's just a non-specific finding. And so I don't bother. I would rather look at function, an echocardiogram, and an EKG to look at risk for future arrhythmias.
And then imaging afterwards, obviously we're going to get a chest x-ray. This kid's likely going to be intubated. I usually advocate, once we get them somewhat stable, to scan them, scan their head as quickly as possible if I don't know the source, because I've had more than one of these turn out to be a head bleed that needed to go to the OR. And it's not as easy for you guys to get it six floors up or at a different hospital in transport if you're not at a tertiary care center. So head CT?
So yes, I would advocate for a head CT as long as you have reasonable hemodynamic stability. So if the patient's on, you know, an epi of one plus norepi or something else you've had to add in the emergency room, probably taking him to the scanner where he's more likely to re-arrest is probably not a good idea. So then coming upstairs, and we'll have to image at some point later. But every kid post-arrest will end up getting some form of neurologic imaging, even if it's not in the immediate post-arrest period. But yes, if you've got post-arrest relative hemodynamic stability, then sending him to the scanner on the way up to the PICU is certainly helpful in terms of overall prognosis. Because if you already have evidence for global injury, you have signs of global hypoxic injury with reverse cerebellar sign, where you have a bright cerebellum compared to your cortex, then that's very concerning in terms of the degree of injury and progression of cerebral edema and brain death. And then for survivors, we're usually getting an MRI several days later.
So once we have these kids intubated, I think vent settings for adults we're very comfortable with, because we don't do it correctly. 500, 5, 15, and 100, right?
Yeah.
So kids, post-arrest, some general guidelines of what we should be shooting for.
Right. So you're going to shoot for a normal PCO2 and a normal PaO2. So like PaO2, probably between 100 and 150 is what you're going to shoot for, because there's obviously going to be some brain injury involved, or global anoxic injury involved. And so you're probably going to initially target, and most of these kids, even if they're intubated in the field, in my experience, have some degree of aspiration event, because they've been unconscious, they've been bagged, they've been intubated, you know, not coming in with an empty stomach. And so there's high risk for having had an aspiration event. Many of them do. And so I'm usually expect to have to provide slightly more PEEP. So PEEP of 6, 7, 8 wouldn't be unusual. And then I would provide a normal respiratory rate and titrate that to your end-tidal CO2 to achieve a normal end-tidal CO2 of about 40, 35 to 40. And so 6 to 8 per kilo tidal volume. Most kids will ride somewhere between a rate of, you know, 16 to 25-ish. And then I time is going to vary based on, you know, age. The little infants probably a 0.4, 0.5 I time. Slightly older kids up to age 2, 0.6, 0.7. School age kids, 0.8. Teenagers, 1. But then really titrating your rate to make sure you don't either overventilate or underventilate. Because again, it's a global anoxic injury, but still, if they have too much cerebral blood flow, you're going to increase their ICP.
I think that's an important point, is we don't want to pop these kids, and we're not used to these. You know, setting a tidal volume of 40 mLs is sometimes like, that can't be right, but it can be right if you have a little tiny preemie. So we don't want to pop them. But the rate, we can really crank these pediatric ventilators up on the rate. So it, just to kind of highlight what she said again, so tidal volume, 6 to 8 mLs per kilo. Respiratory rate, somewhere between about 16 to 25, and then titrate according to your end tidal. So get, put them on the end tidal CO2, get a gas, and correlate what that gas is, what the CO2 on that gas is, to what the end tidal is, and that's how you know what your blood is for a pretty close estimate. And then PEEP, probably a little bit extra if they're in arrest because they've aspirated, so 6-7 is reasonable. And then eye time, somewhere between, I'll just pick in the middle, so somewhere between 0.5 and 0.7. And then 100%, titrate it down as much as you can. I usually like to keep their sats somewhere between 94 and 99 so that I actually know how much oxygen they're getting. Because you can titrate the oxygen down, have 100% on their sat, and only have a PO2 of maybe like 80. Or you can have a PO2 of 400. You don't really know. But when it's lower, you know, okay, with 40% oxygen, they're 99%. That's pretty good. Versus, no, they're needing 90% oxygen in order to keep at 99%.
And then other stuff you'll have to pay attention to in the immediate post-arrest care is really managing their acidosis and electrolytes. So, you know, I often suspect that their ionized calcium will drop, so you're going to have to replace that. You're probably going to have to replace various electrolytes, just depending on what degree of kidney injury they have. They may require additional fluid resuscitation in the early period, because they're going to have a surge response as a result of the total body hypoxic injury, and so they'll get a third space for a while, and so we'll need additional IV fluids. But in the same setting, you have to be cautious about it, because if in fact they're not third spacing, you don't want to fluid overload them. So it's a lot of monitoring and then treating based on lab results and urine output.
Head of the bed, elevated, 30 degrees, put their OG in. And if they have teeth, brush them. And then make sure that you maintain normothermia, which is what we just found out with our THAPCA study.
And then the therapies that really should not be used, which are often talked about. So there's no role for ICP monitoring with a global anoxic injury. There is, because it doesn't improve outcome. So managing according to ICP with bolt in place, and that's really because it's a global injury. It's not a traumatic brain injury where there's some benefit in certain patient populations. And so for that reason, there's no role for placement of an external ventricular drain for CSF drainage. There's also no role for routine scheduled hypertonic therapies. We will use them intermittently. So if you have a kid who's a couple days out post-arrest who blows a pupil, we will give them a dose of mannitol or hypertonic saline on the way down to the scanner so that we could rule out surgical disease. Do they now have a bleed that neurosurgery could drain? Is that why they blew their pupil? Or is it in fact because they've just started to herniate? But none of those other therapies that are classically applied to TBI have been demonstrated to improve outcomes from global anoxic injury, which is what we see post-arrest. So we don't use them.
Katri, that was awesome. We appreciate it. Even though you weren't feeling well, you still did this. We thank you very, very much. We all hope you feel better.
So,
thank you. Since we already started the podcast with some pediatric emergency medicine, we decided to continue the theme into some of our regular segments, which is the community experience as well as Rosenisms. So first, we talked with some of our community doctors about fever without a source. Those are those kids that look great, they don't have any symptoms whatsoever, but they got a fever.
What do you do for these kids? There was a recent article in the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal that discusses the need for lumbar puncture and the incidence of meningitis in febrile neonates. They concluded that children who had a fever but looked well and had an age greater than 21 days did not necessarily have a high risk of meningitis. In fact, none of the kids in their study did. Now, this is a long ways from saying, all right, we don't need to tap anybody anymore. However, the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal is generally a very conservative journal. These are infectious disease doctors. They see the worst of the worst. So for them to publish something like this really stands out to me. I think that there's a lot of changing epidemiology, and this is one of my most interesting subjects in pediatric emergency care, is the rule out sepsis workup, the dance, the fever without a source evaluation, and what we do in the emergency department, because the targets that we're chasing are changing with vaccinations and with other changes in our generations. We're not exactly looking for the same bugs anymore. We are the MRSA generation. So we asked our community providers if they wouldn't mind weighing in on what they would do for that febrile 3-month old that you're just not quite sure what to do with.
Yeah, yeah. So you have a 3-month old, comes in, temperature to 39.1, nothing else. No sniffles, no vomiting, just
three
a fever.
Exactly, or 3 months?
For 3 months from West Africa?
3 months from Liberia, yes. 3-month old with no other source whatsoever. They are exactly 90 days old.
They look good or they look bad?
No, they look fine. Happy, smiling.
Eating, drinking, all good, but diapers.
Peeing, pooping all at the same time.
But in short, everything is normal but the temperature. Immunized kid looks good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the kid's gotten her first round of vaccines.
I'll speak up. I do things. I'm not man enough to do nothing there.
You're a poker?
So I'll get a blood culture, usually order a CRP, and get their electrolytes and probably CBC if there's enough blood, and give them some IV fluid, see if they're perking up and looking good. If they look clinically really well, again, I'm in a community where I can get them close follow-up, and I can call their pediatrician 1 a.m. and be like, hey, they look wonderful. Can you just see them tomorrow and make sure they still look wonderful? And that's usually not a problem. Mm-hmm. I had one, though, a month ago where they didn't look wonderful, and I ended up giving them 4 20 per cc boluses, and she only got more and more mottled and more crappy looking, and so I LP'd her. Mm-hmm. And she did not have meningitis, and then another 6 hours after that, she looked great. Mm-hmm. And she was still in the ER. But we don't admit any peds at my hospital. We transfer the peds out. So.
What about the rest of you?
Labs in the chest. And then if they have follow-up, great, send them out. If they don't have follow-up, sit on them a while, depending on their parents and how confident they seem.
But it's all going to be based on your history and physical exam, just like everything we've said here, The kid physically, clinically looks well and you're just told it's good, they're probably fine. Kids usually are. Mm. But if they look bad, they're probably bad for a reason.
Kids I sit on, they're the one population that I feel like kids and drunks. They
kind of act the same.
I sit on the phone. I'm not one to, the vomiting kid. I'm not one to put an IV in them very easily. But kids, I sit on them for a long time. I watch them and I examine them multiple times. And I kind of, if they look really good, then my workup is really piecemeal for them. They don't get the full court press unless they look mad the moment they hit the door or unless they're 28 days or less. Those kids, it doesn't matter how good they look, they get everything if they get fever.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like she said, I think there's probably belly pain in kids. There's nobody more important to do your serum exams on. Just kind of go back, see them. And for us, I get in touch with the pediatrician in the community too. Let them know that their patient's there. Let them know what's going on. And for them, more than anybody else I deal with, I arrange their follow-up. Like, you're going to see them tomorrow. What time can they be there? Can they just show up when you open your door? So most of the pediatrician's like, fine. Mm-hmm. And, we're kind of lucky from that point of view. I mean, kids are... They're tricky, and as far as doing LPs and all this other stuff, it's just you talk to the parents, and say, look, chances are low. This is potentially devastating. We don't want to miss it, but what do you want to do? Do you want to watch them and follow up with, Dr. you know, pediatrics tomorrow.
I have to say, though, you have to have a measure, like a grain of salt with that, because I agree that involving the parents in your decision-making is very important, but sometimes they're just scared. So I had an adult a week ago with a bacterial meningitis, and he was a chemistry professor, this adult, and he was totally altered and goofy, and so he's clearly not his baseline. His wife's right. Like, well, is this something we really need to do? Like, I'm like, does he seem normal to you? Like, you know, if he has what I think he's got, you know, this is, gets really bad really fast. We can't just wait and sit on that. And there are going to be a few things with kids too, where the parents are all freaked out at the concept, and just, you know, I had one simple febrile seizure in a kid who was fine, and the mother was bear hugging the kid to the point that I couldn't even examine him, and she's, you know, lost her basically, and ended up leaving AMA with the kid in arms to go somewhere else, I hope. But she was just like, you don't understand, I just lost my baby today, and there was nothing, I couldn't even listen to the kid's heart. And you're gonna have to deal with that anxiety. So if you're gonna not do some sort of intervention or testing because the parents are afraid of it, you gotta, I think, tease that out first, because
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the beauty is, and I use this a lot, you know, all of us extra people here have kids. In the end, I just say, if this was my kid, this is what I would do. But, you know, everybody's different. Yeah, exactly. It gives you the feel that you're empathetic. You understand, you have kids. So, yeah, some of us have a lot of kids.
Well, you can tell everybody. Yeah, you can tell everybody. Go ahead and tell everybody. I'm the man.
Peter Rosen's been doing this job for a long time, so needless to say, he's developed several tricks, several tips, several mantras that he uses to get through his daily shifts in order to make his shifts go well, to take good care of his patients, and to communicate well with patients and patients' families. One of the things I've been fascinated by is how people will come into the ER and tell you absolutely everything about their drug use, their sexual history, all kinds of very private things that we've just met them, and they immediately put trust in us. However, when we actually ask them to make some decisions, or if we ask them to do certain painful procedures, other things like that, especially to their children, we can run up against some roadblocks. So my question to Peter Rosen this month is, how do you establish rapport with someone you've just met?
It somewhat depends on how sick the patient is. When patients are dying, they trust you, and their family trusts you, because they want help and you're giving it. And that's all the relationship you need. It's the patient who's less sick that doesn't trust you right away, and then it becomes a matter of, what kind of a doctor are you? How do you form a professional relationship with somebody? If you just come in, take a 2-minute history, take a 2-second physical exam and never see the patient again, of course they don't trust you. But how do you greet the patient? How do you interact with them? When they're not that sick, I always start by something non-medical. In Boston, it's always safe to talk about the Red Sox. Whether it's good or bad, you can always establish a relationship with a patient by talking about the Red Sox or the Patriots. So what is it in your particular geography? Talk about the weather, you talk about rattlesnakes, something. Make a joke, do something to make the patient feel that you care about them and you are a human being who wants to take care of them. I think that a lot of it has to do with the psychology of how much time you spend with them. Because I have spinal stenosis, I don't stand up very comfortably. So I've started sitting down when I take my history from patients. I don't spend 1 second longer with them, but simply the act of sitting down makes them think that I'm more interested in them and that I'm there with them longer. I always introduce myself to everybody in the room as well as to the patient. And if it's a younger patient, I usually start with the parents. But I also start with the child. I remember one of my favorite pediatricians, this guy I wrote many books with, called Roger Barkin. And Roger's a very tall, austere-looking man. And I remember I was visiting him one day at his hospital, and he got paged to the ICU for a kid who'd been admitted for, I think it was croup. And we went up there, and there was one of these typical scenes. The nurse was harassed. The mother was frantic. The kid was wailing. And it was one of these messy situations. And the mother started yelling at Roger, "Where have you been?" He had got the page 2 minutes before and couldn't possibly have answered it any quickly. He ignored her, and he went over to the child and said to the kid, "Give me a hug." And the kid put his arms around Roger, and the whole situation melted away. I was absolutely impressed. And it taught me a very good lesson, which is be a human being first and a doctor second, and people will trust you.
That's really good. That's a good story, too. I've told some of the residents that, especially with parents, if the kid looks well, if your general gestalt is that the kid looks well, that 10 minutes sitting at bedside talking to them like a person will save you 3-4 hours of ED time and thousands of dollars worth of tests.
Yeah, if they think you know what you're talking about because you're a human being and you answer their questions and you really search out their fears. You can't just say to people, "What are you afraid of?" You got to find it out. And there is a fear. They're there not because the emergency department is an amusing place to come to. There are somatizers who believe that, but most people do not. And certainly most parents do not. And the father would probably rather be at home watching the football game, has gotten up to bring his kid in. They're afraid of something. What is it? Meningitis? Cancer? Who knows? Your job to find out. And you know the kid's not sick because he's destroying your exam.
I'm the man, I'm the man, I'm the man. Yes, I am, yes, I am, yes, I am.
Happy May to everyone out there. Brian again, doing a little peer review on some pediatric topics today. So this month, Aaron covered a couple pediatric-based topics, so let's just get into those. The first question he was talking about is, should I cool children after I get Roski after a code arrest? And the study they were looking at was the New England Journal study. And the answer really is no. So this doesn't seem to convey any benefits. I agree with Aaron. I don't think there's going to be another super big study. I mean, this was over 3 years. They started with 1,300 kids. They got down to being able to enroll 290 pediatric codes. And ped codes are rare as is. So to be able to have this many codes in one study is a pretty fair amount. And there wasn't a statistical significance for cooling kids. And we're starting to see this in adults. I think it's more of a preventing hyperthermia. But hypothermia, however good it sounds physiologically, is not seeming to pan out for good neurologic outcomes. So, do I cool kids after Roski? No. Second question. What do I do for a kid if I get Roski? Where do I go now? What interventions, what tests, what do I do? Well, I will be quite frank with this. I have no idea. In my career, though short, still covers about 15 years in the ED, I have had pediatric codes, and I have never had one come back to life. So I'm probably a bad doctor, but that's okay. I can accept that. But you have to realize pediatric codes are never going to go well. Any code is not going to go well, right? Even in this trial, they had a large percentage of their patients, 65-70%, died. So maybe it just every time I'm getting that flip of the coin with that code and my patients are dying. But I can't really speak from experience in this. So just to comment on what they are saying, I think a lot of the key points that they went over were good. I think the vent settings is very simple. Everyone's minute, if you're going to do a volume control ventilation for adults or kids, 6 cc's per kilo. There's only one number you need to remember. I think the other vent comments that they made were increase the respiratory rate is good in kids, right? They have a normal respiratory rate that's much faster than an adult. So just think about if you're putting them on the ventilator, you may want to increase it and then really just seeing what they're going to do on that vent. The other thing is whenever you do have a code for a pediatric situation, whether the patient gets return of spontaneous circulations or does not, you just need to prepare the family either way. Don't give them false hope. Tell them exactly what's going on, what you think is going to happen. The longer a child is down, the less likely they're going to have a good neurologic outcome. If there is something immediate that they were able, that you were able to respond to and stop, maybe some hypoxemic event that you were able to break and got return of spontaneous circulation back in a short time period, that child will probably do better than someone who's been down for an hour. So just prepare the family either way. Have them at the bedside. I think that's important for pediatric codes. Bring them in. Talk to them about what's going on. Talk to them about what your thoughts are. You're never going to be wrong with sharing ideas with them and communicating and keeping them in the loop. This is a very traumatic experience for any parent to have. And so the more you can relate to them as a human, the better you're going to be and the better they're going to deal with the situation. Other thoughts is that pediatric codes are rare events. Even if you work in a PEDS-ED, you probably don't see a lot of pediatric codes on a daily basis. So for most of us who don't work PEDS-only shifts, even, you know, where I've worked before, I've seen 25-30% of my cases have been PEDS. Do we get a code every day, every month? No, they're pretty rare. So are you going to be a super expert in a rare event? Probably not. But do what you think seems logical and call for help. If you get Roski in one of these kids, call the intensivist or wherever you're going to transfer and talk through ideas. Talk to them about, well, I think the kid's looking dry, I'm going to try a fluid bolus, or their blood pressure's low, I was looking to start some pressors, here's my thought, what do you think, epi, norepi? I think I'm going to try to prevent temperature elevations in the patient and see what they think. Order labs you think they're appropriate. If you're worried about a toxic ingestion, maybe add those on. I agree with Aaron, probably troponin, not a good idea. There's going to be some troponin leak from the damage. What are you going to do with it? You're not going to cath these kids. Do labs that are appropriate. Do treatments you think are appropriate and ask for help. And then think about where you want the child to go. If you have an intensive care unit and they're going to take them in your hospital, make that phone call. If you need to transfer them, where's my transfer center and who do I need to send them to? Third topic was 3-month-old male has a fever, no symptoms, got his 2-month shots, and otherwise looking good. What are you going to do about this kid? And so Aaron asked this to some of the community providers as well and got their feedback. So from this community provider, my answer is nothing. I do nothing with this child except administer Tylenol, hug them, high-five the parents for staying alive, for having a 3-month-old and getting some kind of sleep, and try to get them home and out of my ED. Brian, that's crash. That's reckless. You're not following guidelines. You're just doing random stuff. I don't understand, Brian. Why? Why? Well, my take on this is I end up dividing these little febrile with looking good and no other symptoms and no source that you've identified with different age groups. So for me, 28 days and less, fever, they're getting everything. They're getting their antibiotics, they're getting their LP, they're getting their labs, and they're getting a bed upstairs. If they're 28 days to 60 days in my book, which 60 days in a sense, I use my first vaccination date or first vaccination maybe within a few days. But they need to have had a vaccination. If they haven't had their vaccination, they're in that 28 to 60 day area. And for these kids, I will test them. I will probably do a blood culture and test their urine and test probably a lumbar puncture. Antibiotics, yes or no, and I'll talk to their pediatrician. And sometimes the LP I don't always do if I can get them to see their pediatrician. The next day, I don't always LP them if the pediatrician's on board with that. So I try to get a care plan together. If they don't have a pediatrician, what do I do? Well, I decide, am I going to see this kid again tomorrow? So if I'm working the shift the next day, I can have them follow up with me. If I'm not working again and they're going to follow up with someone else, I will probably do more tests. If they have no follow-up and won't come back and they're going to run away to some foreign country that I can never catch them again, I may consider admission in these kids for an observation period. But if I have that third group, They've had one vaccination. They're greater than 60 days. They look good. And they have a fever. I will look them up and down for any sources I can find for serious bacterial infection. I'll look for a cellulitis, push on their belly, listen to their lungs, try to check their ears. No, I don't think acutotized media is a source of fever in children at 65 days of life. But I look them up and down. Are they eating good? Are they happy? They have a normal neural exam for that age. Are they breathing right? If all that looks good, I will watch these kids. Now, are there recommendations by guideline associations who like to, say, cath these kids and do urinary catheters and blood work and cultures and other stuff? Yes, there are. Are all guideline organizations correct? No, they're not. Why are guidelines made? Oh, that's a whole nother topic, so I'm not going to get into that. But my take is most of these kids do well. If they are looking good and acting appropriately and you can watch them, I want to see what happens. Because I see patients with fever for 1 hour. I see patients for fever for 6 days. Those are two different patients. I don't know what to do with the fever for 1 hour, right? Are they going to develop another symptom in 2 hours? And they're going to have fever and a cough? Are they going to have a fever and a runny nose? They have fever and vomiting? They have fever and a rash? I don't know. So I like to give those patients time and testing a bunch of stuff and trying to poke and prod a child that early does not make a lot of sense to me. Now, if I have a kid who's had a fever for 6 days and no other source, I may be more concerned about Kawasaki's and maybe doing other tests and looking for it. So I let the time frame in which they've had the temperature also affect my decision. Now, I had a pediatrician when I was starting to have my first boy about 10 years ago. He said, "Brian, take your thermometer and throw it away. Just like get rid of your thermometer." I was like, "Well, that sounds crazy. I always had a thermometer growing up and it was stuck in my butt, my mouth, and everywhere. It was just delicious." But he said, "Look, if you want your baby in the first month of life to be stuck and poke and prodded, then keep a thermometer. If you don't, don't keep a thermometer." Well, I said, I don't want little Thor to get a needle in his back and a catheter in his penis. I mean, that doesn't sound comfortable to me. So I didn't take a temperature. But what he did say was, if your kid's not acting right, you need to bring him in. So that's kind of the thing I've been doing. If kids aren't acting right, they're not eating, they're not drinking, they're not pooping, they're not breathing right, they don't look good, then they should probably come in. Now, again, I know I'm going out on the edge, I'm talking crazy talk, so this is my opinion on things, and we know what opinions are. They're like certain parts of your body, everyone has them, and they all smell, so, but that's my practice pattern. And I have 20 lawsuits to say that I'm doing okay. Only 15 kids have died on my watch, which is good. But no, that's my take in reality. And I'll tell you, if it was my 3-month-old boy who came into the ER with a fever, why? I don't know why I would bring my kid to the ER with a fever, but if for some reason I did, and they said, "We're going to do a bunch of tests, and we're going to stick things in their wee-wee, and we're going to stick things in their back," and I would tell the doctor, "The hell, you're going to urethrally rape my child. I'm not going to let you put a catheter in his penis. That is wrong, wrong, wrong." So I wouldn't do it for my kids, nor have I done it for my kids. But you have to make that decision on whether you want to test or treat these kids. I don't do a lot for these kids. They look good. I observe them. I watch them. I talk to the parents. I give them some Tylenol. And it's close follow-up and see what the disease progresses. I think sometimes we have diseases that aren't necessarily known right away. They get a couple early symptoms. In a little tincture of time, you let them progress and see what happens. Sometimes they like, wow, their cough, runny nose. Boy, it looks like it's just a viral illness their brother had. That's what they have. Or maybe it's fever and a petechial rash a couple days later. Oh, you missed the LP. Well, did I really miss the LP? You know, am I going to LP every kid? Say the kid was 6 months old. Well, it wouldn't be indications. Guidelines don't say I should LP every 6-month-old with fever. They look good at the time, but I just let them develop symptoms and you treat them at that point. So you have to think about what you want to do with this. I think there's a lot of overtesting, and as Aaron was commenting in this article, we're really, with vaccinations, eliminating many childhood diseases that were serious bacterial infections and killing things. And so we keep looking for them, right? We used to have real diseases, and now we're looking for things like 4 white blood cells in the urine and calling it a urinary tract infection. So let's think about what we're actually going for and what are we trying to accomplish in these kids and what your goals are. So anyway, long rant. I'll stop on that. So we finished up with Peter Rosen talking about just some tips and tricks of how to relate and form that patient-doctor relationship, both with the parents and the pediatric patient. I thought that he had some really good points and a really nice story about the pediatrician just diffusing a situation with giving the child a hug and holding on to the kid. So I agree here. I think making a connection with children and the parents immediately is a good start to any of these encounters. I like to find a topic, like Peter said, not related to what's going on. I may ask them about their symptoms right away, but then we're going to talk about something else. My cues for this are looking at kids' t-shirts. Kids like to wear what they're interested in, and they will put on a Barbie shirt if they like Barbies, and a Transformer shirt if they like Transformers, and if they have a Hulk shirt on, they're probably a fan of the Hulk. So look at what they're wearing. If they're wearing nondescript clothing, I then will look at their shoes or hair or earring paraphernalia and ask if I can trade with them. Hey, you know, Johnny, can I wear those shoes? Those look really nice. You want to wear my shoes? And a lot of times that will get a chuckle out of a child, like, you can't fit in my kid or my shoes. Ha ha ha. Like, oh, let me try. Come on. And again, it just diffuses the situation and takes it a different direction, puts the kids at ease. The parents like that you're relating to them. So try to make a quick connection. I like to use clothes or toys. The other night I used a kid had a stuffed raccoon. We started talking about the raccoon. His name was Bob, and that went off on a whole different tangent. So anyway, make those connections. The other thing I like to do with to put the parents and kids at ease is I like to tell them what I think's going on after they tell me the symptoms. I'll tell them, you know, I think this is likely a viral illness, but maybe you had some, you know, your fever and congestion. Why don't we do something for that? And then you're telling them, yes, that something's going on, but you're also addressing what you're going to do for them. And, you know, I'll say, Johnny, would you like some medicine to help you feel better? And Johnny usually wants some medicine to feel better because he's not feeling good right now. And Johnny, would you like a popsicle? All kids need popsicles, and all kids need some kind of liquid Motrin, Tylenol, Benadryl, Zofran combination of deliciousness. And if you throw some Dex in, you've probably treated 95% of children's illness, and you'll probably be able to send them home. So I like to tell them what I'm thinking, give them some medicine, and then you know, like Peter said, get into what their concerns are. So if at the end of our talk, you say, Mom, Dad, you know, is there anything you were concerned about, or what were you worried about you wanted us to check out for sure? Oh, we're worried, you know, if he had appendicitis. Okay, well, I think it's possible he has appendicitis, but let's do some exams here. And if everything looks good, we'll have him come back in 12 hours and do another exam on him, because I agree. I think you did the right thing to bring him in. Validate that they came in. That's important. To address their concerns, yeah, I think it's appendicitis, and I think we should do some exams. And maybe we don't do radiology because I don't want to radiate your child, but maybe we have them come back in 12 hours because the symptoms have been going on for such a short period of time. Tell them those things, and they'll get on board with it. Come back, do the exam. Boy, Johnny's looking good. He's eating his popsicle. He got his Motrin and Tylenol in. All right, Johnny, you want to go home and come back in the morning? Yeah, I'd like to go home. Okay, let's get Johnny home. You know, you get them on board. And at this point, or earlier, the last thing I like to do is lay hands. I will lay hands because I think that's an important thing of being a doctor, whether that's laying hands, stroking a child's head, holding a parent's shoulder, and telling them that they're doing the right thing. They've had a tough time. They're not getting sleep. They're worried about their child. This is their first child. The laying of hands is so powerful, and if you can become good at it, and know to do it not in a way that's awkward, not in a way that's, it's a very organic and natural way, parents and kids will love it and be much better with it. And they will really see that you are trying to make that connection in a very difficult scenario with a sick child, all parents are unhappy. So anyway, good pediatric topics. Thanks, Aaron. And I missed you again this month, Jared, but I'll call you and send you some sweet nothings on the side. All right. Everyone, you guys have a good May, and next time we'll be talking to you in June. Summertime.